We are going to talk about how the National Park Service is preparing for the sequester budget cuts and welcome your questions and concerns. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, March 18th. What will a 5% budget cut mean for the national parks and for park visitors? Do you think these cuts are okay or not? Should the parks be exempt from budget cuts? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our first guest is Lynn McClure, Midwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group for the national park system. She joins us from her home in Lake Geneva. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks for being with us. So how bad are these budget cuts going to be for the national parks?
Well, I was just thinking when you were telling everybody what we'd talk about that nobody had really put it to me that way before. No, these cuts are not okay. I was just thinking, I want to call in. I don't want to be a guest. I want to rant, Joy.
You can rant right now. Why are they so bad?
Well, they're bad. They're bad because for so many reasons. The national parks are loved by many. The national parks are doing so much more with less money already. There are a lot of reasons, and I'm sure we can get a lot of those today. But, you know, these sequester, unless you're really watching the cable news channels and all the policy wonk shows, the sequester is a tough thing to kind of get your head around, but you know, you look at across-the-board cuts. If you had to make some cuts to your own budget sitting at home, I don't think you'd make them across the board. I mean, I'd rather take 10% off of my mortgage and find the biggest savings, but I don't think it'd go down too well with the bank. So, you know, I have to look at where else to cut, and I'm going to maybe cut 10% off my kid's allowance to try to save some money. And I think cutting from the National Park Service budget is a lot like cutting from your kid's allowance. It's not very much. It's 1/14 of 1% of the entire federal budget, and it's something that's pretty valued. Your kid needs that allowance.
So how significant is this 5% across the board? How much is that in terms of actual dollars?
Well, it's about $130 million in additional cuts through September 30th, which is the end of this fiscal year, because that $130 million is the 5% of an entire year's budget, and there are only 7 months left in the fiscal year. So the actual impact felt in the amount of time left in the fiscal year is closer to 9%. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of playing with numbers, but when you get down to what visitors feel, I think that's when it becomes very, very real. And there are visitor centers that will have to close, not permanently, but some hours of the week. At parks like Gettysburg National Military Park, they're having to eliminate 20% of their student education program. So all those kids who head to Gettysburg during the spring will still be able to go, but their programs are going to be cut. They're not going to have the ranger there or the interpretive person taking around the park. The impact they've been able to get it down to is only about 2,500 students, which is pretty good when you think about it. But Glacier National Park, one of the major roads in that park, the Going to the Sun Road, is delaying reopening. At Yellowstone, they're hoping the snow is going to melt on its own because they're having to delay some of the snow plowing to get the park open in April and May when they usually do. So, you know, I mean, these are things that visitors could start to feel as kind of an insidious creeping that you'll see as visitor centers delay being open and if there aren't rangers there to get you hooked up with what you need.
When this sequester deadline wasn't met, a lot of people argued that the sequestration really wasn't that big of a deal because the earth continued to turn and the sky didn't fall in. But these are cuts that we will feel down the road.
Yeah, and I think this is the hardest part about it because the day, what was it, March 1st, March 2nd, nothing really happened. So the only way to cure these problems is to have Congress right the wrongs. The only way they're going to turn this around is to have people complaining. And when you don't feel those cuts right away personally, it's very difficult to do that. So I do understand what you're saying. Before taking the cuts into account for the Park Service, for example, the budget was already 15% lower than it was 10 years ago in today's dollars. And National Parks were already suffering from operating shortfall of about $500 to $600 million a year, with maintenance backlogs of $12 billion. So, you know, they were already doing things. And when you talk with Bob Krimenacher from Apostle Island a little later in the show, he'll be able to tell you. And they were already cutting travel budgets, not filling vacant staff positions. So if somebody leaves, it's the way it is, and taking a ton of other cost-cutting measures, including the number one visitor on visitor surveys every year. The number one thing to visitors is making sure the bathrooms are clean.
Mm-hmm.
And you call any national park superintendent today, and they will tell you, well, not going to be super clean this summer when people visit. We just don't have the staff to do it. So, you know, these cuts come on top of already bare-bone budgets.
So how important are the national parks beyond scenic beauty?
Well, here's where I get on my soapbox. I mean, national parks, anybody in the world outside of America is so envious of our national park system. It captures the beauty. It captures the important stories and preserves those important stories of our kind of shared past. It gives everybody equal opportunity to experience these places. In other countries, you have to, well, in England or in Europe, most of the big parks were protected as private areas for the wealthy, and if you could afford to go there, large estates and gardens and what have you, then you went there. But in America, for the most part, national parks are free to visit. Some have an entrance fee, but there are places in those parks where you can still get to free of charge. So they're really that kind of that important thing that belongs to all Americans. They're a wonderful treasure, and doing so much with so little that it's a shame to kind of cast them aside, I think, in this sequester.
How concerned are you that people may hear this news of cutting back on cleaning toilets and opening roads and closing visitor centers, and they may decide not to visit a national park?
Yeah, I'm not overly concerned that people won't visit. You know, it's kind of funny if you look at the trending visitation at national parks over time. It's really hard to figure out why they go slightly up, slightly down, but are staying pretty steady. I think it's 280 million people visit national parks, almost 300 million a year. And, you know, when the economy took a turn in 2008, there was a slight bump in 2009 because people maybe weren't going as far on vacations, but it's pretty steady. And I think that when people visit the national parks this summer, they need to bring their sort of support with them. The parks are economic engines that support more than $30 billion in spending, more than 250,000 jobs throughout the country. And so people need to visit to experience the parks, to support the businesses, and when they get back home, to let their members of Congress know they had a great time and spent money at local businesses and would really like to see them well-funded.
So, Lynn, are these cuts a done deal, or can they be rescinded or adjusted?
Well, as far as the sequester goes, I am not the national park policy wonk,
right,
and can't get into the weeds and tell you how this great thing can be undone. I do know that the Park Service, especially management, have been doing quite a lot of numbers crunching for quite a long time, and already I suppose we should all feel fortunate that some of this happened during the off season when visitors weren't at the park, because so much personnel was tied up in trying to figure out where they were going to cut budgets that I think it would have been an extra big impact had all of this happened during the summer. But I'm sure that this is a fluid thing. It's probably a better question for Bob, but as they go along, they'll just have to see where to move the limited staff they have. This is why philanthropic organizations, friends groups for parks are so important. Right now they're going to have to step up and play a pretty big role. They may not be able to provide funding to the parks to hire people, but you know, they can help offset some of the costs, hopefully.
Our guest is Lynn McClure, Midwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group for the national park system, talking with us about the effects of the sequester budget cuts. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions and concerns about this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. How concerned are you about the sequester interfering with your plans? What questions do you have about how the budget cuts will affect the national parks? National Parks officials say that they will be opening roads later, closing visitors centers, furloughing park police, and hiring fewer seasonal workers. Just some of the effects that may result from the sequestration budget cuts. Coming up, we will talk with the superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore about how those cuts are being planned for locally, so to speak. That's one of the few national parks in Wisconsin. We'll talk about that coming up in just a bit. Checking our statewide weather forecast, it's going to be cloudy today with snow, a slight chance of light freezing drizzle as well throughout the day, areas of blowing snow this afternoon. We can expect high temperatures ranging from the upper 20s in the north to the low to mid 30s in the south. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, March 18th. Coming up this afternoon during At Issue after 3 o'clock, news reports consistently warn that the deficit is on an unsustainable path. In actuality, our deficit is down to sustainable levels, according to John Munson's guest, after 3 o'clock. It's another edition of At Issues Econ 101 with economist Kevin Quinn, coming up after 3 this afternoon. Well, we're talking about budget cuts and the effects on our national parks during this hour, and we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your views and reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Are you planning on visiting one of the U.S. national parks this year, and how concerned are you about the budget cuts that the national parks are dealing with these days? Let me welcome now Bob Krummenacher. He is superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. He joins us from Bayfield. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for joining us. So how are you at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore dealing with these sequester cuts?
Well, it's going to be, as Lynn said, visible this summer, but it's not visible quite yet because, frankly, we're still covered by snow. We don't have any visitors at this point. But this year's budget cut of 5% comes on top of 5% that we've absorbed over the last 2 years. So it's really a cumulative 10% cut. And, in fact, we haven't had a budget this low since 2007. And when you adjust for inflation, it's beyond my visibility. I've been here 11 years and we've never had a budget this low adjusted for inflation. So we go into this with very little flexibility. We've essentially done microsurgery in about 20 places around the park, trying to keep the cuts from being terribly visible and terribly impacting. But I have to tell you, the patient is on life support right now.
Wow.
If there's anything else that hits us, if we've got a big equipment failure, we're going to be in a world of trouble. But as Lynn said, it's kind of the same story here. We'll have a lot fewer seasonal staff this summer. 87% of our operating budget in a normal year is fixed cost, and so the entire sequester has to come out of that 13% that's left, and that's mostly our seasonal staff. So we'll have half the number of seasonal rangers and maintenance folks that we normally have that are funded from our operating budget. We'll have shorter hours in our visitor center. We will have shorter seasons for just about everybody in the field. Visitors who come in the early part of the day or the early part of the season, I think we'll see it probably more than those later in the season. But Lynn set me up with a toilet story, and really, that could be where people see it the most.
Well, I don't mean to be, you know, flippant here, but so what? Why doesn't somebody else clean the toilets?
Well, we've got toilets out on islands, 21 islands that range from a mile out in Lake Superior out to 25 miles out in Lake Superior. And so it's not a case of cleaning toilets for us. It's a case of pumping toilets.
Uh-huh.
These things are vault toilets that are designed so that we don't pollute the water of Lake Superior, and they fill. And we've got a cycle whereby we bring a big vessel, a landing craft out there, which has a pumper truck on top of it, and it's all contracted these days. And we've had to cut our contracts back by 50%. So we will be good the first half of the summer, and we, of course, can't predict the weather and the visitor patterns later in the summer, but we're going to be watching it really closely, and it's possible that some toilets will fill and we won't have the capability of bringing the heavy equipment out there in order to pump it.
Yeah. So I asked Lynn, and she said maybe I should ask you, is this a done deal, Bob? Is there no hope of getting the money restored for the national parks?
Well, you know, that's a case, you know, that's kind of above my pay grade in a lot of ways. It ends up being a political thing between the Congress and the president, and you know, there are real issues financially around the country, and these are big public debates, and the national parks in some ways are the tail at the end of the dog. It's not what people are really talking about, and while there are some in Congress, I think, that would love to exempt the national parks from the sequestration, I don't actually think that's very likely, and so, yeah, I think this is pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
We've been expecting something like this to come. We didn't know if it would actually be sequestration, but even in the best case scenario, we thought this was going to be a really tough budget year. And what I really fear right now is that if we do have a grand bargain of some sort, this could be the future. This could be the new normal for us. And it's going to be really challenging for the visitor, and ultimately the resources that the parks are here to protect are going to suffer.
Yeah. What's your reaction, Bob, to there was a report that at least one anonymous national parks employee, a park ranger, said that these cuts were being made to be as painful as possible, and questioning whether the cuts really needed to be put where they were put. What's your reaction to that?
I remembered when I was a seasonal park ranger 30 years ago and how little I actually understood about the finances and the decisions that superintendents made. So part of it has to do with what chair I'm sitting in right now. But, you know, we got very clear advice that said this is real, and do what you have to do. We were told don't hide it necessarily. In fact, we were told don't try to pretend that everything is fine by keeping a facade good but eroding it from underneath. So we're being very honest about it, and I guess to some that looks like we're being very dramatic about it. You know, there's no closures that we're anticipating at the Apostle Islands right now. Except perhaps some of these toilets late in the year. I think most parks are working really hard to try to avoid the worst, but what people don't often understand is what I said earlier, that there's very little discretionary money in our budget, and we have to take the entire cut from that, and most of that is the stuff that's highly visible to the public during the summer season.
Yeah. Well, this concerns a lot of people, I'm sure. I love the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. I've only been there a couple of times, but I would love to visit again. But, you know, maybe this isn't the summer to go, Bob. Are you concerned that people will avoid the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore because of this?
Well, I hope by being a guest on your show, I don't drive people away.
Oh, no. But listening to, you know, toilets being closed and such.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that's really going to be a problem. What we've found most years is that when it gets hot in southern Wisconsin and the Twin Cities, people come up here because it's nicer here than where they are there. And I think that will still be true. You know, I think what I would advise people is check with the park staff. You may have to wait a little bit longer for a return phone call if you call our visitor center. But we'll still be there. We'll still be trying to serve the people that do come. One thing I want to point out, Joy, is that there's a huge economic impact of this and every other national park on the surrounding communities. And we employ year-round about 30 people, but in a typical year, a total of about 75 people when you include the summer staff. But that translates to about 350 or more jobs that we support indirectly in the community and over $20 million in Bayfield County and Ashland County. So cutting back on the national parks also cuts back on the economy of those areas that depend on those national parks. And that's going to be, you know, so I think the Bayfield Chamber of Commerce and the surrounding communities, they are as concerned as we are about the impacts.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, George.
Bob Krumenacker, superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Also with us is Lynn McClure, who is Midwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association. And we just have a minute before a news break. Lynn, anything you want to add to what Bob was telling us?
Well, I want to start by saying I've already planned my trip to Apostle Islands in August. So Bob is right. People do go up there when mm-hmm. it's warm in the southern part. And I think people will. This is the time people are planning vacations. And they absolutely need to continue and keep going ahead. And Bob was right. Make calls ahead and find out. I mean, these are beautiful places. You don't want to cast a horrible pallor over them. And on the other hand, this is very real and something that people just have to understand is going on.
Yeah. Again, just 30 seconds or so before this news break, where are some of the other nearby national parks?
Well, if you take the ferry over from Milwaukee to Michigan, mm-hmm. Sleeping Bear Dunes along shore, just a jaunt up onto the Upper Peninsula from Apostle Islands, and you can get to Isle Royale, to Keweenaw National Historical Park. I mean, there are really quite a few in the Midwest that are quite beautiful and are huge tourist destinations.
We will check news and then we will be back continuing to talk about budget cuts and our national parks and welcoming your questions and your reactions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about how the national parks are planning for and dealing with budget cuts and what it might mean for the parks and for visitors. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Monday, March 18th. National Parks officials are saying that some of the effects of the sequestration budget cuts include opening roads later, closing visitor centers, furloughing park police, and hiring fewer seasonal workers. Are these budget cuts going to keep you away from the parks? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Do you think that these budget cuts are just the way it has to be, or do you think that this is wrong? We are talking with Lynn McClure, Midwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group for the national park system. She's joining us from her home in Lake Geneva. And our first caller is Kate in La Crosse. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to comment on, I know the national parks are beautiful and I love them and have used them frequently, but another reason to keep them open is the massive amount of research that goes on in the park that affects things in our daily life that we don't even realize. I have both a brother and a daughter who have done research in our national parks and then have gone on to use that research in other areas. And a lot of it is privately funded or government funded, but yet they use the pristine nature of the national parks for this research. And it has to do with everything from, you know, animals to water to forestry. And so I just wanted to make that comment that that's another reason to keep our parks open.
And presumably funded. Lynn, that's right. There's a lot of research going on in our parks.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that Kate said that. It's not something that I would have put out there as a frontline thing, because on the surface it doesn't affect visitors as directly. But she's absolutely right. There is so much that goes on at national parks that it doesn't have a direct impact on you and me as a visitor. And one of those things is that many of the national parks are places for globally known research. I mean, the national parks have endangered species and have new species being discovered all the time. Many universities send people to the national parks to do the research. I know my organization, NPCA, for example, took a group of a dozen or so students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Science to Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, which is about 35 miles south of Chicago. And we did that because it was, we had this opportunity to take young people into a national park and to better understand, you know, why they were doing wetlands restoration at this park, for example, and why the national park's role in science, and then the policy that was involved in making that science possible, as well as the federal funding that went into it. So we took our own kind of view and piece in that research, but Kate is correct. There is a lot of research done, because that research has to have things like permits to do it. It has to have a National Park Service staff liaison for these research projects. These are going to be the types of things that may have already had an impact in cuts, because the research projects don't tend to have a direct impact on visitors. And so parks are going to look to cut some of those things that don't have direct impact on visitors, so that you and I visiting won't feel the cuts as much, if that made some sense.
No.
So she's right.
Thank you very much, Kate. So you would dispute the National Parks ranger who said that he thought that cuts were being picked, especially for the pain that would be inflicted on the visitor?
Well, I think that I think that it's very hard to understand how these decisions are made unless you are at the top or in the decision-making loop. I have experienced a lot of the anxiety that's been going on in the Park Service of where to make these cuts, of how they'll be made, of are there going to be furloughs? I mean, of all the employees in the Park Service wondering, since Congress talked about this sequester for the last, 2 years, I think, or so, am I going to be furloughed? Am I going to be out of a job for a while? I have a family. I have bills to pay. Now, the Park Service right now is not going to be furloughing employees. They're just not rehiring positions that are open, and they're not hiring seasonal rangers. That has an impact, however, on people who would have those seasonal jobs. Many teachers, for example, counted on summer employment with the Park Service to make their full year. A lot of rangers in the summer are teachers. So I understand somebody saying that about the cuts, but I don't think it's true.
Yeah, and if the national parks aren't hiring seasonal rangers, the things those seasonal rangers were doing are not going to be done, or maybe some of them will be done by others, but you can't take it all on.
Well, that's right, and maybe some this to give you a couple of examples at Badlands National Park in South Dakota. Their 5% cut basically is equaling, they're going to be hiring about 25% fewer seasonal rangers than they used to. Now, that supports things like the interpretive walks, the talks, school programs, some custodial services, road and fence building, repair, maintenance. Some of those seasonals had some science and research component to their salary. Some of them did natural resource monitoring, so, you know, just being out in the field and checking on all those plants and wildlife and features that the park was established for. Search and rescue, by and large, will not be affected. I know there, you know, most the national parks are not going to want to directly jeopardize visitor safety. And the superintendent at Denali National Park in Alaska, for example, said that he may not be filling positions, but those will likely be for things like the park historian. I know he's got a couple of IT positions open that are grieving his staff right now that will not be filled, but the search and rescue personnel will not be affected. But he also said, you know, that these people that he's not hiring do things like cleaning gutters and maintenance. He says you can only go out for so long without cleaning a gutter before your roof starts to be lost. So, that it'll eventually have a direct impact.
Well, Pam on Facebook writes, these budget cuts come just when I am trying to plan a fall visit to Yellowstone. Maybe everything will be okay in the fall. I know they are moving the snow plowing of some of the access roads to later in the season than usual. Well, will everything be okay in the fall, Lynn?
Who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really dependent on Congress. I am not a political prognosticator, but they don't look like they're moving very quickly to me. For Pam's case, you know, sometimes when people visit Yellowstone, you know, you request a backcountry permit to go in the backcountry and camp. These all have to be looked at and approved by park staff. You have to be assigned. You have to get the rundown on safety by a park ranger. So working this far ahead for a fall tour is an excellent idea, and making sure you've got all the kind of details in place, I guess, in order to make that fall trip good, and then just keep checking. What I have been reading is that, you know, if a national park has six campgrounds, for example, they might have to close a couple of them. Grand Tetons National Park, for example, is contemplating closing three of their five visitor centers right now. So I'm sure these will be the less frequently visited visitor centers, but they'll have an impact nonetheless. So you just want to really, really do as much as you can to plan ahead and check in frequently with the park.
Is there any talk of raising fees if there is an entrance fee for a park, or the cost of passes to get into a park to offset the cuts?
Well, that is not easily done for good reason. The entrance fees are at those parks that have them are set very low so that visitors can afford them. If a park wants to start charging an entry fee, there is a fairly long public process that they have to go through in order to establish it, and it wouldn't take effect this year. And they have, for good reason, to take public input and study all revenue streams and determine whether it is critical that they charge an entrance fee. As far as raising it, there's a slightly, I think, less onerous process, but one there nonetheless, in order to make sure from visitors that and the public that that's okay. And I think that many people would argue that there are still many, many people out there who have suffered from job loss or bad economy and count on the national parks and the low entry fees and the low camping fees so that they can have a family vacation. And raising those fees to the public wouldn't necessarily be the right idea. So, you know, I think Bob alluded to it a little bit, but this is a time when parks really have to rely on those volunteer bases that they have. There are volunteers who do lead a number of the talks and a number of the walks, and even probably clean the toilets. But they're just absolutely going to have to rely on them more than ever this year.
Yeah. Well, in closing, are you concerned that this is the new normal for our National Parks Service?
I sure am. I sure am. I don't know how this can be sustained for very long. I know a lot about the national parks. I don't know as much about other important areas of the federal budget that I am sure are suffering similarly. But what I can say about national parks is that they are getting less and less money coming in from the federal budget. They are being more and more creative about how they use it, and they are forming more and more partnerships with private, public-private partnerships in order to make what they do have as good as they can. But, you know, we look at how to take care of these special places over time, and I look out into the future, and I worry very much about a Congress that doesn't appear to be prepared to protect what Teddy Roosevelt asked them to protect so many years ago.
Yeah. Well, I won't put off that that trip to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. What about you? What park are you visiting this summer?
Well, I am going to Apostle Islands. Oh, yeah. I go almost every summer. I am also going to be going to Kenai Fjords and Denali because I have a child who lives in Alaska, and we've planned a trip to do that. But we are doing lots and lots of checking in before we go.
Yeah, and I will too. Denali's on the list as well. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Lynn McClure, Midwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group for the National Parks System, talking with us about the effects of budget cuts on our national parks. Coming up after 7 o'clock, by the way, we will have a special edition of our State Capitol Report. We will hear from the two candidates running for Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice. After 7 o'clock, we will welcome in the incumbent Justice, Patience Rogensack. And after 7:30, we will hear from the challenger, Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network. It's time now for our Monday morning wake-up call, prompted by a New York Times article on gun control measures and suicide. More than 60% of gun-related deaths in the U.S. are suicides, but the debate over stricter gun laws isn't really acknowledging this. And according to our guest this hour, it will take more than the current set of gun control measures to reduce that statistic. We are going to talk about suicide prevention with Dan Rydenberg. He is the executive director of SAVE, which stands for Suicide Awareness and Voices of Education. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, that statistic really surprised me or shocked me. More than 60% of gun-related deaths in the U.S. are suicides.
That's right. You know, we've had a long-standing history in this country of suicide by firearm. And although that is dropping ever so slightly, the challenge really is that just dropping that isn't going to solve all the problems because we're seeing rises in other forms of suicide. So it is a complicated picture.
Yeah. So how many people are affected by suicide?
We lose about 38,000 people per year in this country to suicide, 38,000. It is in the top 10 leading causes of death. It is the third leading cause of death for youth in this country. We lose more people to suicide every year than we do to homicide and DWI and HIV, pneumonia, the flu, many others, all combined, actually. So it's a tremendously large number.
Yeah, and then all of the families involved, too. So why wouldn't better background checks for gun sales reveal people who might be suicidal?
Well, because being in a suicidal state of mind is very often temporary, short-lived. Sometimes it is literally minutes, maybe 5 or 10 minutes. sometimes for some people it might go on for a day or two. So most of the time, people's mind, even though they might be struggling with a mental health issue, they're not actively suicidal. So while it might help, it isn't necessarily going to be the thing that drops our numbers of suicides.
Yeah. The article was revealing in that a lot of people who do commit suicide, they might have been perfectly fine earlier in the morning, or at least not suicidal, and then something happens or their thoughts go to suicide and they'll kill themselves just in a matter of hours.
Well, that's correct. I'm glad you said that, because we want people to understand that there is quite a bit of impulsivity around most suicides. About half of the people we lose to suicide make the final decision within about 10 minutes of their death. So that's not a lot of time to get to emergency responders, get to a doctor, get to a hospital. So we need people to be around and be available to them, and that's why we try to raise awareness to the general public about this. But when it comes to firearms tend to be very, very lethal. Not always, not 100% of the time, but pretty close. About 98% of the time, somebody who's suicidal uses a firearm, they actually die. So when they're fine throughout the bulk of the day, and then something triggers that for them, and there's access to a gun that can be very lethal, and it's very quick, we see people dying by suicide and get very concerned.
Yeah. So are there gun restrictions that would help prevent suicides?
Well, yes. I mean, we do think that background checks would make a difference. They're not going to drop us down to zero suicides, but they might make a difference in terms of screening out some of those who have more of the chronic, more serious, and persistent mental illnesses. Gun locks would also help. Gun safety measures. So we train people on what is safe storage for weapons like that. Educating family members that when somebody is struggling with a mental health issue, that they need to remove the guns from the home. Those are the kinds of things that can really change our numbers relative to firearm death.
You know, besides gun laws or gun policies, are there other policies that might help prevent suicide?
Oh, sure. For example, in Europe, they use blister packs for medications. So you might get one of your medications, you might get six tablets at a time. And the reason for that is that it slows down. It's harder for somebody who's struggling just to get to the pills, to get them out of the pill pack and enough of the pills at one time. So there are things around prescriptions. We can also change how doctors prescribe. We could actually make laws and enforce laws that doctors can't prescribe 90 pills at a time to a patient just because it's cheaper for the insurance company. So there are many different ways that we can go about preventing suicide through different laws and legislation.
What should we do if we suspect someone we know is suicidal?
Well, the first thing is to ask them. If you have a gut feeling inside you, or you're worried about someone by their behaviors, by their statements, you need to ask them. And you need to ask them really clearly. Don't ask, hey, you're just not doing so well today, but rather ask, hey, are you feeling like you just want to die, or you just don't want to be alive anymore? That way you connect with where their head is at, and if they say yes, make sure you stay with them. Don't leave them alone, because when you leave them alone, it increases their anxiety. So stay with them, get them to help, go with them to help, or contact somebody else who can get them some help. But if you suspect somebody is suicidal, you need to ask, you need to stay with them, you need to get them to help. And there are people who might say yes, they're suicidal, but aren't actively. So they're not in the moment thinking about it. Maybe they thought about it a week or two ago. Well, schedule some time with them. Make sure you check in with them on a regular basis. Make sure that they have a provider that's helping them. Make sure they're taking their medicines the way they're prescribed and going mm-hmm. to therapy the way they need to. Those are the things that are going to prevent suicide.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dan Rydenberg is Executive Director of SAVE. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.